everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that can finally say for sure with this episode that no, Robert De Niro does not grow up to be Marlon Brando. Mr. Ford Coppola, you lied. You very, very much lied. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And while Dave was talking, I was busy ransacking his apartment. I'm Andrew Canningeaser. And Dave, what are we doing this week? Who are we and what are we all about?
Well, when we're not busy making failed jokes, what we do here at Filmstrips is take a look at a film each and every week, dissecting it, looking at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, looking at the production details, maybe talking about all the wonderful ins and outs that may have went on in the film. The important thing is, beyond the fact that we spoil the living hell out of everything, is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed on the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Last time we were looking at the sweet, airy slice of sponge cake that was Frank Oz's In and Out, a film that you and I think is fair to say, we were pleasantly surprised to see that it held up a little better than we were fearing, and we decided to push our luck with director Frank Oz, who we have decided to follow 4 years later to 2001, and up to the old harbor fronts of Montreal for his heist film, The Score. Now, granted, when you think about the movie The Score, you're probably not thinking of Frank Oz. You're thinking about the fact that it is a film featuring a cast that includes Robert De Niro, Edward Norton, then very much on the up, Angela Bassett, and in his last film appearance, the one, the only, Marlon Brando.
Yes. Yeah, so there's going to be some things to be said there, and we'll get a bit more into the how this movie was marketed, I think is a good way to put it, here very shortly. But I mean, like I said, I guess the big question is, Andrew, do people remember The Score?
I mean, honestly, it does feel kind of forgotten. Maybe, as we'll get into, not necessarily to put it in the pantheon of lost classics, but watching it this time, I realize the heist movie itself has become something very different. I feel like this is much more in the vein of Clockwork Precision, and focusing on the tiny details, the Michael Mann, as opposed to the Ocean's 11, or the, what is it, Now You See Me, where they're all magicians?
Yeah, the Now You See Me and Now You See Me Too.
Yeah, and I mean, so it's, in some ways, it's almost quaint to return to a narrative like this one, because it really, as we will get into, and as I will probably get into at length, this is surprisingly a very minimalist kind of heist film, but more in the sense of subtractive design. And, well, I mean, here to tell you exactly what it is in its skeletal form is my man David, because he's gently elbowing me in the chest to invite him to give us the rundown.
The Score is the 2001 heist film from director Frank Oz. Robert De Niro stars as Nick, a Montreal-based thief looking to retire, who's roped into a high-stakes job planned by a hot-headed up-and-comer by an old friend. Meeting with solid critical notices at the time of its release, The Score would prove to be a solid box office performer and feature the final performance from legendary actor Marlon Brando, coming up after Filmstrips, a special broadcast of The Tonight Show episode hosted by Rod Serling.
Like, Frank Oz as a director, probably not necessarily given the auteur treatment that many do. Like, there's not the same sense of what a Frank Oz film is as opposed to a Stanley Kubrick film, you know? That being said, I feel like In and Out last week is a lot more stylistically close to what Frank Oz does most of the time. Because, yeah, I'm thinking of works like Bowfinger, Death at a Funeral, Little Shop of Horrors, that dreadful and completely inessential Stepford Wives remake. And then it seems like The Score really jumps out on that list. Because there's also, like, nothing light or silly or parodic about it. But also, David, you mentioned that this is the second time that Frank Oz has been on our show, and that is incorrect.
Really?
Yes, because I don't blame you for blocking it out of your memory. The brain does interesting things under trauma and stress. Frank Oz also appeared as the warden when you, me, and our good friend Chris Martin
Oh.
took a look at John Landis's Blues Brothers 2000.
Right, yeah. And yeah, how could I possibly have blocked that out?
That's okay. It also means that Frank Oz has been on our show three times by the time that Marlon Brando was on it once.
Well, yes, and yes, we should note here that, yeah, we do have a number of returning players here. We have Robert De Niro for his third appearance, desperately trying to keep up with Al Pacino. Howard
Yeah.
Shore making his fourth appearance on the show after being.
Yeah! Howard Shore is a sleeper on our show.
That's right. I mean, he's, been here for Naked Lunch. He's been here for Seven, That Thing You Do, and now this. And he will probably get the most praise for me this episode. I will say that for sure. Again, Ode Bronson Howard will be making her second appearance on the show after doing the costume work on Angel Heart as well, because,
Wow.
yeah. So, I mean, we've got, I probably mispronounced her first name, I should note as well, so my
Maybe De
apologies.
Niro is the type where he's like, "No, I gotta travel with Audie. She's the only one who can make me look good."
It could be. I'll have to pay closer attention to those credits. But
And we
yeah.
also have cinematographer Rob Hahn returning from last week as well, who shot In and Out. Also later would be the cinematographer on Stepford Wives.
Yeah, and he brings the exact same level of excitement that he brought to this film that he brought to In and Out. Whether that's
I am going to push back against you there later on. But
yeah.
let's not get ahead of ourselves. I
Yeah.
mean, ordinarily, and Dave or I, were I we were just discussing whether or not it even needs to be said. Like, this is a film that, I mean, production is fairly unremarkable, but also the production of this film kinda is self-explanatory. Because, I mean, even though you have a script by Lem Dobbs, who I think this is a couple years after The Limey, or is it before?
I think it might be around the same time as the Limey. I'm not
No, I think
exactly.
it's after, because Limey, I think, is 99. This
Okay.
is why you do your research before you hit record, kids. You know, it seems like if you say a heist film directed by Frank Oz, nobody really gets that excited about it. However, if you tell a group of studio heads a heist film featuring Marlon Brando, who was the Hollywood, like, capital A actor for the better part of the last 50 years, Robert De Niro, who kind of picked up the mantle from him, and now Edward Norton, who certainly in 2001 was very much being positioned as like that studio craftsman type of actor, very much like the young star on the rise. And suddenly you say you have those three in a heist movie, it really doesn't matter what the rest of the content of the film is, right? Simply having these three guys on screen together is, I mean, in a cynical sense, that's the only reason for this movie to exist.
Well, and here's the thing. Like when you and I th this is I th guess my big thing, because I remember when this film was marketed and was released back in 2001. That was the big hyping point. We've got Brando, we've got De Niro, and we've got Norton, who like yeah, I was riding high off of Primal Fear and with Fight Club and other films that were really building up his
Yeah,
cachet
because I
as.
remember the even the home release, I'm pretty sure that like the poster has the names before the title, and it's just De Niro, Norton, Bassett, Brando, and it's like, yep, this is what you're here to see.
Well, exactly. Although if you're here to see Bassett, boy, are you going to be disappointed. But we'll get there.
Yeah, I know.
The thing here is that yeah, this is a film that was really hyped around. It's like we've got three generations of great of like the leading men of Hollywood. Our current generation, our the previous generation, and are your grandpa's generation all together in one thing, and it's going to be like a
Yeah.
face-off between them. And let's be
And I
clear.
mean, that's not to say this is necessarily like the first time that's ever happened in film. I mean, film has plenty of great instances, both of sort of like the symbolic passing of the torch. I'm thinking like Schwarzenegger's cameo at the beginning of The Rundown or something like that. Or like Harlem Nights, which we talked about before, which was Red Fox, Richard Pryor, and Eddie Murphy all on screen together.
Yeah.
Granted, I mean, you can definitely understand why studio heads, who are by and large Caucasian, would put marketing resources behind a film like this, in ways that a film like Harlem Nights did not receive.
Well, I think Harlem Nights did receive it, but mostly it was, here, check out the Eddie Murphy vehicle, more so than anything else, was the way it was positioned at the time. It really wasn't positioned in that same way as, here's, you know, three generations of black leading actors all together in one film. Yeah, when it came to this film, this was hyped up as, like, that's the big thing. This is what everybody's talking about. And in some ways, it makes a degree of sense. And I mean, certainly, I mean, because let's be honest here. Again, as we were just acknowledging, Frank Oz is, I think, a very respected filmmaker. I think more people know him as an actor overall. And I think, you know, it's not that he hasn't made great movies, because I think Little Shop of Horrors is a straight up classic.
It has a very specific vibe to it, though. And it's a vibe that you typically would not think lends itself to three very, certainly quotes around in marketing terms, three very legitimate actors, you know?
Well, exactly. And the thing is that usually when these kinds of, you know, with these kinds of projects, let's go back to something like Heat, which I think is a comparable example in the sense that...
Yeah, actually, that's a much better example.
Yeah, mostly because that one is, you know, this was two of a generation's greatest actors that were finally going to share the screen together, even if it was for only one scene. Because up to that point, that hadn't happened. They'd been in the same movie together in The Godfather Part 2, hence my joke at the start of this episode, but they were never in the same scene together because De Niro's stuff was all flashbacks to playing the young version of Brando's character from the first one. So,
because it dawns on me that it's easy to take for granted how many people have seen The Godfather. Yes, they're both in it. Brando's in the first one as old Vito. De Niro's in the second one as young Vito, but they never shared the screen.
Exactly. And that was a big selling point. And the thing is, on top of it, which, you know, again, you had a pretty significant, you know, heavy filmmaker there working with him in the form of Michael Mann, who, whether you love him or hate him, is a significant figure and is somebody that commands a great degree of respect amongst cinephiles.
I think the Heat comparison is also very apt because this feels like a similar kind of heist movie with, like, high gloss blue filtering aesthetics. Though, as we'll get into narratively, they are doing radically different things with the heist format.
Yeah.
But the other thing about Heat is that it also, it's not just them as the center characters, it's that there's a massive ensemble of very talented actors filling out this world.
Well, and that's the thing where with Heat, it's also, that was a very personal film for Michael Mann. He had been sitting with that thing in his head for almost 20 years, I believe, by the time it actually arrived in cinemas. And you'd seen it go through multiple permutations before we finally arrived at that movie.
I'm going to anticipate your question and say that you can't necessarily say that there's that same visible level of passion in a project like this.
Well, there isn't. I think, as part, let's take a look at our writer's credits, because the story for this film is by Daniel E. Taylor. Who is he? Well, apparently he wrote something called Rainbow Valley Fire Department, which I know absolutely nothing about. Was then had worked on it by Cario Salem, who wrote Chasing Mavericks and the Rat Pack TV movie from 1998. Again,
yeah.
I haven't seen either. I can't make judgment calls. And then Lem Dobbs, who, again, was sort of... The basic way, I guess, to think about his career is that he spent a lot of time working as sort of, I guess, a script doctor would be the best way to look at it, because he worked on things such as Dark City, a film which had multiple writers on it. He did work on The Limey, which was probably his most famous work, as well as Haywire, Steven Soderbergh's movie.
Yeah, because I'm also fairly sure for The Limey, did he not win Best Screenplay for that?
That I can't remember offhand. But again, probably most recently, he is infamously known for his work on the film Gotti, the John Travolta Vanity Project, which we may want to keep in mind. So the thing is, you have three different screenwriters who, based on their credits, were not working together at any point. This was very much we brought somebody in and then we brought somebody else in on top of that to rework, which that's not a signal that it's a bad movie, but it's also a signal that there was nobody who was seeing this thing through from beginning to end as, this is the movie I am hellbent on making.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I don't necessarily want to frame this film off the hop into negative or stark terms, but I agree with you completely. Like, filmmaking is a collaborative enterprise, and often we're biased to assume, like, again, holdovers from auteur theory, that the fewer participants in the narrative of the film, the better it is, simply because it's like the audacity of executing your vision, right? And that's totally fine, but once again, it's like, it almost feels like they got the three actors to agree first, and then they found a script for them.
Well, and this is the thing. Ultimately, this film goes into production. There's not a lot of detail on how that went down, other than the two major points. A, for once, Montreal is playing Montreal in a film.
Yes.
But this opens up...
In fact, yeah. There are a number of scenes when he climbs out of the sewer. That's actually a bar in my old neighborhood.
I'm pretty sure I actually, but back when you, me, Drew, and James all were back at the Montreal Comic Con as guests for 24 Panels Per Second, where we talked about comic books on television and comic book cinema of that year, 2013, I believe that was.
Oh man, that feels like a lifetime ago. But yes, yeah. I can confirm that we have definitely walked through some of the locations.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's nice to see Montreal playing Montreal, although, as I will note right up front here, a distinct lack of French-Canadian accents all around in this movie. If you wanted to sit there and say American expats apparently all hang out in Montreal and populate it for the most part, this film would convince you of that, I will
say
that.
It's like Paris in the 20s, you know? Yeah. These things are cyclical.
Yeah, but the big thing here is, I will say, is that you've got that. The only other major thing from the production standpoint is that Brando and Frank Oz didn't get along, which honestly isn't that surprising because, A, nobody basically seemed to be able to control Brando after a certain point in his career, if ever. I mean, if Francis Ford Coppola couldn't do it while making Apocalypse Now, Frank Oz wasn't doing it in 2001.
Well, exactly. That's sort of the downside to being like, we are going to work with, like, a Hollywood royalty, because you gotta remember that these guys have spent their entire lives believing their own hype.
Yeah.
And Brando, you know, there are many, many anecdotes about his eccentricities and downright toxic and abusive behavior on set. He was an original, I'll give him that. But yeah, it's also like, okay, well, let's calm down, Owen Gleiberman. I mean, him not getting along with Frank Oz is not quite like him showing up to set 200 pounds heavier than everyone thought he would be.
Well, yes, although with also some slight fairness to Brando as well, Frank Oz, by everything I have ever read about him, is a bit of a difficult personality himself. He's got by his own admission, he can be a fairly frank and aggressive individual to deal with, and he's got more than a little bit of ego to him based upon his... discussions about his fallouts with basically the Muppet crew following Disney purchasing them and deciding to go forward with the Jason Segel Muppet film, I believe he was one behind that one, and a number of other incidents.
Didn't even realize that the Muppet house stood divided, and I'm just sad hearing all of this.
Point being here, Frank Oz has a bit of a reputation for being a rather difficult individual himself from time to time to deal with. So again,
well, yeah, you don't become a puppeteer as a vocation because you're well adjusted.
Well, I was going to sit there and say you don't take on becoming a director as a career because you're well adjusted.
So it's even worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, but the big point here is, aside from that, there's not a lot of behind the scenes stories. By all accounts, post-production went fairly straightforward. And is there even pretty fine.
Like, this isn't a film where there's a rumored lost cut or anything.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you know, Norton came out after the fact and sandbagged it and said, oh, they did too many passes on the script and they took out the interesting subplot.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, yeah.
It's a movie that ends up being what they wanted it to be. And I think what you and I were talking about before we start recording, like, I think we both have a pretty similar assessment of this film. And so I guess the real question is, like, is that going to be enough for the viewer?
Well, and I think this is my big thing either. And we'll just lay our cards out on the table right now before we dive into it. Because I'm sure we'll, as we go through it, this is what's going to be the thing we keep coming back to is, I think the score, the film that was released, made by Frank Oz, is perfectly fine. It's a fine heist movie. It's an adequate heist movie. It hits all the beats you are going to expect from it, but it doesn't do anything particularly exciting with them. The characters that De Niro, Norton, and Brando have been given here are characters they could honestly play in their sleep, and in the case of Brando, may very well have been doing.
Oh, come on. No love for Maxie?
We'll get into Maxie and some things about him as we go here. I mean, it's just a case where it hits all the buttons you would expect, and in many ways, it's very much old white dude porn for basically, oh, I love those old heist films, and it's a guy who owns a jazz club and things like that. You know, it's really classy in that. Like, it's
a classier version of the Expendables in some ways.
Well, and this is the thing where it's like, well, yeah, this is all fine. I mean, you all very clearly grew up loving a lot of old heist movies and a lot of old, 1950s movies where there was hot jazz soundtracks and that, but ultimately, does it really merit the fact that, this film cost, what was it, like $40 or $50 million and starred, three generations of heavyweight actors who don't have anything, aren't really given anything to do? Well, not really. I mean, this film could honestly, if you recast it with much cheaper actors in the same role who have equal amounts of charisma, I mean, I don't think this would be a conceivably all that different movie. I mean, overall. I mean, yeah, this could star Steven Weber, and there's a version where Steven Weber, with his own contemporary actors playing beside him, would be just as fine a movie as this.
I think that would work as long as Ed Norton still played Jack. in some respects, I think maybe he is the most dynamic performance of the film, albeit not necessarily a perfect one. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, and I mean, that's why I think it is so funny that the credits for this film, not only do they have script credit, but as you noted, Dan Taylor gets a story credit. Because the story of this film is, like, beat for beat predictable. Like, there is no twist or turn that the audience isn't always already conditioned to see coming, I guess. And, like, this film telegraphs its plays. So, and I guess it's more like I don't understand why there's a story credit, because I think the interesting thing about this film is comparing it to Heat, where, you have Macaulay and Hannah, but you don't just have the heist, right? You have their lives, all the people in them, how they manage to make sense of life on their side of the line, and it really expands outward both sides of the cop-criminal divide. Whereas here, this is a film that closes in, where it's like, your life really doesn't matter outside of the job. You know, who you are, what you did, none of that matters. And so there are moments and certainly scenes that I know we talked about with Rivnak in David Mamet's screenwriting, how when it works best, it can turn simple phrases to be absolutely loaded with suggestive meaning. And I mean, that's not to say that, like, the best films in the world make you think about other films that you aren't seeing or anything like that, but I don't know. I feel like this is a film that has a very sharp script, has very clever dialogue, and, like, despite its predictability, the fact that you have three very talented characters, they are making the most of sort of those open spaces within the script. So I think it's a good example of, like, the absolute maximum you can flesh out characters while having an absolutely restricted overall narrative. Does that make sense?
It does to a degree. I guess where we'll probably end up differing as we go is to just how, where the line between fleshed out and sketched in is as we go here.
And that's not to say that I think this film does everything evenly or even necessarily well. I would say it's a pretty good film. It's in my B+ range. Which, more than fine. There are a lot of movies that get made. There are certainly things that could make it more distinctive and better. But I mean, as we've noted, like, the marketing is all about the dynamic between the three men. All this conversation is probably going to be about that dynamic. But the narrative itself kind of mirrors that, right? Where, in broad strokes, We are watching three generations of actor play three sort of generations of criminal as well. You have Max, played by Brando, who's sort of the fence slash the operator character, who connects people, sells things, and takes care, and goes off to his house in the Bahamas every now and then. And, you know, he's the old one that can't do anything by himself. We've got, well, what's his name? It's not Neil in this one.
Nick.
Nick, played by De Niro, who is the expert safecracker, the cold professional who prefers working alone, always takes safe bets, and is looking to finally get out of the game, if only De Niro did so. And, well, maybe it's not the highest note of his career, but there would be few high notes after this one. And then you have the young, enterprising sort of hotshot with something to prove in the form of Jack, played by Ed Norton. And long story short, the three of them now come together in Montreal to pull off one big score that's wickedly risky compared to how they usually work, to retrieve a gold scepter from a Montreal customs house. And that's really the story of this film. That's what I like about this film, though, is that, I mean, it pretty much sets its parameters very quick. Because how do we open? We get Nick on the job, right?
Well, yeah, and this, you know, we see him basically in somebody's home, a fairly well-off mansion, from what it appears there, where it seems at some corner of the house, a big party's going on from the music we hear thumping through the walls. And there is Nick, as he's working on a safe very diligently, and we are given, and again, probably the closest bit I will give Frank Oz to where this feels like a Michael Mann film, where we're definitely seeing the process of cracking a safe.
Yes.
And the
action, a lot of close-ups on the hands, a lot of lingering shots on the tools themselves.
Yeah.
The actual operation of being a safe cracker.
Exactly. And that stuff kind of works. But what we end up having here is the way the rest of the scene plays, and in, which I think in many ways sort of encompasses this movie as a whole for me, is that suddenly there's a noise. Somebody's walking into the room, and Nick has to hide. And sure enough, it's a couple coming in to basically potentially engage in the act of coitus, we will say there.
Yeah. There's not a lot of foreplay before. They're pretty much wrestling with each other while Robert De Niro crouches beside them.
Yeah, on this couch, and then suddenly she wants to have a cigarette and finally tells the guy to basically get off. And he's fine. He walks out of the room. She lights up the cigarette. She suddenly notices, you know, the bag of tools and other equipment that's in the room. And sure enough, De Niro grabs her by the mouth, walks her over to the safe, tells her, do not turn around. You know, you will not get hurt. Basically grabs what he needs from the safe, which I think, what is it, pearls or something that are at this point
in
time?
Yeah, some jewel items.
Yeah. And then he basically says, do not turn around. Leaves the room. She doesn't turn around. He gingerly walks to his car, gets in, and then drives off. So if you were expecting something fairly tense or exciting to happen at this point, does it really do that?
Dave, I think you're also being a little reductive here, because you got to remember that that whole sequence, that comprises a big part of it, but while the credits are going, we also see Macaulay, as he goes through the very routine motions, driving towards the border. We realize he's going into Canada. We soon learn that he lives in Montreal and only does jobs elsewhere. But we also see him as he goes through the process of driving at night, the resignation, and like the fact that it's Robert De Niro starting to look old and weathered.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things where this movie can only tell its story the way it does because it's made the way that it is. Because, yeah, we see Nick tired. We see him walk home. We see him change the decal on his van. We see him walk through secret doors and that. And, like, you're right. It's not exciting. We see it as procedural busy work, and it ends with him coming home, sitting in a chair, grabbing a drink, and then just sitting back while it zooms in on his face, and it's the universal expression of, I am getting too old for this. And I think that's why it's effective, because overall, what the film ends up doing is Jack becomes the character who is more exciting. He is more willing to break protocol. He is willing to buck the rules and ignore De Niro's advice. You know, he's the one who brings a gun to a handoff and that. And it's like he's trying to manufacture his own excitement, and that's what ends up being his downfall. So really, if anything, the film is the victory of staying the course.
But I think, but here's the thing, you're not wrong, and I get all that about this. And number two, Gary Farmer returning for his second time, finally on the show, as basically Nick's right-hand man who first meets... let me double-check the character's name, I wrote it down in the notes. Yes, Bert, here. And... God, I wish he had more to do in this movie, but we'll get there. The big thing here is that you're right. The thing is, De Niro did this movie. It was called Heat, where he plays a guy who's getting old and who's bored and he's looking for something in his life and doesn't take risky bets. And the thing about it
is... But see, Heat is very much dualism, though, between cop and criminal. Whereas here, it's more generational between criminals.
Well, this is the thing, but I think the thing about it is that it sets a pattern for the movie that isn't just a matter of these guys competing lives. It becomes the structure of the movie itself, where it is, no, we stay the course, we do what we do, and we don't do anything too exciting or too dangerous or anything that will get the audience's blood pressure up, anything whatsoever at any point, because let's be clear, probably most of our target audience will have heart attacks if we do anything too much. That's the feeling I get through a lot of this movie. And again, that's not inherently a bad thing necessarily, but
well, there's also a fine line between a slow burn and nothing happening.
And that's where
redeems the film, though, is that everything that happens at a narrative level is basically in pursuit of, like, we almost get the micro steps that have to happen because, you know, if you want to sketch this film out in big strokes, we have Nick returning to Montreal. Max is back and tells him about the job. Nick is resistant. He ends up meeting Jack, who's in on the job. The two of them begrudgingly start working together, figure out a plan, case the joint, prepare for things, learn how to work the safe, learn how to deal with a blackmailer so we can hate on 2001 hacker kids. The job is carried out. There's a betrayal, but it's not really a betrayal because De Niro outsmarted him. Happy ending.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And pretty much all those beats you will be able to predict going forward.
And so... it's like Carlito's Way, as we've seen, or like Bruce Lee films, you know? It's literally the second that De Niro puts down the phone and walks off with Angela Bassett, like, that is literally the end of the film.
Well, yeah, and I think that's the thing, where that's perfectly fine as long as what's happening in the details is really engaging and interesting. And again, for all the talent that's been brought to this movie, it only intermittently hits that point. Because let's start with... probably our first big scene, because along with realizing that Nick is in, when he's in Montreal, runs a jazz club, because of course he runs a jazz club.
It's the thing to do when you're an aging criminal.
Well, exactly. And of course, the only people who speak with French accents are basically his employees here. Because again,
but if he didn't own a jazz club, then we couldn't have that scene where they were singing about desire and letting it overwhelm reason if you want something.
Yeah. But this, yes, leads to our first scene where, Brando walks into the film as Max. And here's my first thing. At first, I thought, oh, Brando's trying for a French-Canadian accent. And then I realized, oh, no, that's just how Brando sounds now. He realized, like, he's not doing anything. He's just slurring his lines. And I'm not entirely sure if he's intoxicated or just unwell at this point. And
he's just this bizarre figure in the movie. Because Max walks in, impeccably dressed, very heavy-set, and, oh, Nick, didn't see you train last, and you were back in town, got some business to attend to, all that.
But then...
who are you, man?
But
like,
and I think...
I remember seeing this film when I was a kid, and being like, this is that guy everyone loves?
Well, and I think this is my thing where there are ways to make that work for your film. I don't know that Frank Oz finds a way to do it because it's just like you have everybody else that's in the same movie. And then there's Brando over here who's completely off in his own direction. And I mean, De Niro is trying to meet him at the halfway point, but it's barely working as it's going on these things. And you basically have the scene play out where Max is, and again, it's a straightforward scene where Max is basically telling him, it's like, we've got this case. It's going to be over here at this customs house. It turns out they've got this rod from this French king or something that's, you know, hidden in a wooden leg of a piano. And, you know, we can get it out. And, okay, that there's a way to make that scene work when you've got some really great dialogue that's going on and you got the actors firing it back rhythmically and, you know, really making it sing. And they aren't really given anything interesting to say. They're not.
See, it's not that the dialogue is interesting, but there's a snappiness to it. Like, and it feels, it's weird because, I mean, you were saying in the notes that you've seen this film described as noir. And yeah, I firmly agree that that is a stretch.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a snappiness to it. And I think it's like a sort of musicality of the dialogue itself that I just enjoy listening to. Like, because even in that early scene where it's like, so come on, can I interest you in this caber? He's like, no, it's too risky. I'm not doing it. Come on. What about for $4 million? You wouldn't want $4 million in your mitt? And like, it's sort of... The other thing is, like, I feel like this film, if it's trying to do anything, it's really trying to be a David Mamet film, and it isn't.
Yeah, and that's the problem, I think, for me, is that it's aiming to do that. You can see where they're going. You can see what they want to be.
It's like if you took Ronan and the Spanish Prisoner, and they ran together at high speed and melted, this is what you would get.
But emphasis and, I mean, on the melted part.
Both of them are fine enough films. And I mean, the more we talk about it, the more cynical about this film I think I'm going to become.
Yeah. Sorry, Andrew. But I mean, I think this is my thing where it's just like, for me, like I can see where it wants to be those things. It's just, and again, it's not that it's totally off base, but it's just off enough. Where, you know, whether it's a case of the pacing, whether it's a case of the performances, whether it's a case of the dialogue itself, something isn't clicking quite into place to, I mean, it's pleasant to watch. And that's what I think. It's like, I didn't watch this movie and hate it or actively get angry at it for the most part. I just watched it. It's like,
for 2 hours, it moves along quickly enough. And I think that's owing to sort of like the structure where it's stage by stage to get to the heist, and then it's over.
Well, and this is the thing. And I mean, so you have this scene, and then you cut to the introduction of Angela Bassett's character. And again, let's be
clear. That is a great scene, though, because it doesn't matter what's written on the page. Like, I am surprised her and Robert De Niro, like, have such a warmth between them, but, like, their characters don't reveal much of themselves. They're not even given much to say. But, like, you almost... I do like where it's like, you know, what happened to Johnny? And it's like, he got one in the neck in Istanbul. He was pretty good. Mm-hmm. Good and dead now. And like, it's just, you could give them anything to read. And actors to the caliber of Angela Bassett and Robert De Niro, you know, they're going to do great with it. So it's not surprising that they're fantastic in the few scenes they have together. But I mean, I see what you're saying, where imagine if you gave them material that, you know, required all of their ability.
Well, and this is the thing. It's like, I do like their initial exchange at the door, and part of it plays like, it's like, oh, is she another fellow criminal? Is she somebody else that he knows? And no, ultimately it turns out she's aware of his activities, but she's a flight attendant.
Yeah. And that's disappointing. It makes her, like, when that's revealed, it would be better if they just stay in the illusion of not knowing who she was. Because the moment that it's like, nope, you're a flight attendant, it's like, okay, well, that's your box of what your character gets to be.
Well, what's even worse is when you finally figure out what the arc of this movie is, where it is, yes, you know, Nick is thinking of retiring, and she wants him to retire. She wants him to walk away before he pulls that one last job. Those words get spoken, by the way, in this film. One last job. But, yes, you know.
But to the film's credit, it's not quite like Carlito's Way either, where, like, I think if the film has a strength in the scenes that Bassett's in, it's that, you know, Nick talks to her and he's still kind of guarded, but he's like, what do you think about living with a jazz club owner? And she's like, that's something I think about. And he's like, and what if that's all I was? He's like, what do you mean? He says, what if I stopped doing that other thing? And then she says, I would have to think about it. And I mean, I like that because that happens before any reveal of what she does or anything, because it does bring up the idea that it's like, well, you might want to walk away from the life, but maybe the fact that this woman loves you because you're interesting, or as she points out, it's because he's uncommon that she's drawn to him. And the thing is, the film sets that up. You have actors that could easily act out what you could write for that story, but not only does that not become a subplot of the film, it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, that's my problem, is that you raise that possibility,
because, yeah,
and then...
you're right. Subsequent scenes very quickly become, no, I've decided I love you, I want you to get out of the life, don't do that job. And then we end with romantic completion.
Well, and that's the thing. All her character is in this film is a goal. And again, there is something about the fact that, like, Angela Bassett, like, it's not like she was an up-and-comer in 2001. She had been working a good long while already, had had leading roles in feature films by this point in time, okay? So the fact that she's in this movie for maybe, if you consider it, 10 minutes
what,
out of a
four
two,
scenes?
Yeah, four scenes, 10 minutes max out of a running time. In that final scene, I don't even remember her getting any dialogue. So,
yeah. And like Brando probably is only in the film for a comparable amount of time, yeah. But his character is given much more clear narrative import. So it's noble that they included Bassett in the last names on the poster, but it seems kind of disingenuous to do that as well. Also, like, her character in this film should have been given the screen time and the arc of De Niro's girlfriend in Heat instead of whoever played her there, because that is the kind of actress that can play this role. Not like one of the stronger performers in Hollywood.
See, I will defend Amy Brannigan in that film, but I will say that, yeah, Angela Bassett, if she had been in Heat, yeah, that would actually be an upgrade as well. I'm not going to disagree with that.
But it's like, why cast such distinctive people to play indistinctive characters?
Yeah, but and this is the thing, and it's just frustrating when all she gets is to walk through the motions, do those dialogue, and have the scene where she gets frustrated. It's like, you said you were getting out. It's like, I just got this one last thing. You say, oh, and then she walks out of the room. And again, even when they have their next meeting, all it is literally, I kid you not, De Niro's Nick looking down, seeing her arriving at the restaurant. See, we don't see the follow-up conversation. We don't see what goes on between them. We have to infer that things may or may not have gone well. I don't know. I mean,
well, exactly. Yeah, they had dinner and then he was like, I promise you, Kay, in 5 years, I'll be totally legitimate.
Well,
oh, wait,
exactly.
That was another film.
But the point here is, yeah, so I mean, everything with Angela Bassett in this film is just a crushing disappointment. But with that scene, after that initial scene, we finally see Nick walking down the street of Montreal, where he's approached by a character... Yeah.
Well, I don't think we could scene by scene this one, but Nick is immediately reluctant to do the job, because he's like, too many unknown variables, plus it's in Montreal, you don't do it where you eat, as it were. And then he's approached by Edward Norton, who immediately makes his appearance in the film by playing the same character he played in Primal Fear, effectively.
Well, let me be clear here, folks. Yeah, he's basically, and this becomes central, and I do want to highlight this for reasons.
He's playing a very stereotypical idea of what a mentally infirm man would be like.
And let
and
me
it's
be clear.
Pretty gross to look at.
And that's my thing, where it's like, look, I wasn't willing to accept it when Bill Bixby did that in The Death of the Incredible Hulk. I'm not willing to let Edward Norton slide in this movie. And it's the thing where it's like, again, for the purposes of the plot, there's a reason that's going on, but it is like, it's full on stereotypes. And it like,
and like, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, just it. I get it. I certainly get, like, there's a way that you can salvage it narratively where it turns out Jack is the evil character, or Jack is taking advantage of the fact that people routinely disregard neuroatypical people and stuff. But at the end of the day, this is a film that's 2 hours long, and there's an aggregate 20 minutes of Edward Norton acting, like, in... acting like he's special, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not something I necessarily want, and that's not something that's necessarily a good test of Edward Norton's ability.
Well, and it's the thing. And when, I mean, the basic point here is that he's approached, in terms of the plot, we shall say, he's approaching Nick and he lets it slip very quickly that he's Nick and that he's the inside man, which Nick does not take well to. In fact, so much so that he actually sends Bert over to basically threaten Jack and to get him out of town. And I will say this, number one, in no way, shape, or form do I buy that Edward Norton would turn the tables on Gary Farmer. I am pretty
You would be surprised, David. It is entirely true that all it takes is one punch in the right spot.
I believe that that's possible. I also believe that basically, if this were an actual fight, Gary Farmer would take Ed Norton down.
Yeah, Gary Farmer can brush his teeth with Ed Norton in terms of just like size proportion. So I do like his chances, but yeah.
Yeah.
Because he goes over, you know, we see the scene of somebody in Norton's apartment, and then we see massive Gary Farmer holding a baseball bat in the frame, roughs up Norton, tells him to leave town. Norton then punches him in the neck, whacks him behind the knee with the baseball bat, and says, okay. And I do like for the rest of the film, whenever the two of them are in a scene together, they're making eyes at each other.
Yeah, that is at least one decent running detail I like. But basically, he goes over to Nick and back to Nick's place with the baseball bat and points out to him, it's like, look, I admit it was a dumb thing I did. It was risky, but I just want you to hear me out. That's all. And sure enough,
because ultimately what his plea is, he's like, look, I know you think I'm just a kid. You don't know who I am. But I am very good at what I do. I know I've got a lot to learn. I respect you. Just listen to this plan. And the whole thing is, he's put it together, but he can't do it by himself. And that's why they need Nick.
Exactly. And this leads to, I think, what is actually the only scene in the entire film where Brando,
where all three of them are together.
Exactly. Yeah. And the thing is okay, not to keep coming back to our Heat comparisons, but the scene between De Niro and Pacino in Heat when they're having that cup of coffee, that is dynamic writing. That is amazing performances. And those two are rapid firing off of each other. And it's all about character at that point in time. We get the three actors here in the scene, and it's all exposition at this point in time, where it's like, here's what I've done. This is what I'm doing. This is what I've put together. And you get the odd flourish in the dialogue where Brando's chuckling about, you're not going to believe the ridiculousness of this. They have no idea what they've got. Like those, like you get that, but
the piano got impounded because Asian longhorn beetles, termites.
Yeah,
exactly. Because of termites.
Yeah. And again, we get laid out that yes, it turns out that this scepter was hidden in a leg of a piano, and Norton's Jack in his disguise as Brian basically had to convince them to, you know, no, look, and save it from the fire. Now they have it in a lockup down in the basement of this customs house.
The more frustrating aspect of the scene is that, you know, they say film is a medium where you show instead of tell. This is a film that shows us while it's telling us the same thing throughout this sequence.
Yeah, and I mean, there are ways to make that work. This film doesn't quite pull it off. It's just, it is a massive exposition dump, more than anything else.
Like, I'm trying to think of sort of, maybe like a more, I don't want to say gimmicky, but like a focused kind of experimental film. Something like Run Lola Run, where like, that's very much about a very set structure, very concerned with like timing and small details and that. And it's like you almost think that this is where this film goes, where it just then ultimately like the world shrinks down to just the job, just the details of getting through it, seeing it to the end. But at the same time, we get all these weird asides, though, at the jazz club, and we get all these weird moments of Nick wringing his hands about the decision. And so it's like the film only shrinks down and focuses on, like, the specific minutiae of the job. It takes the worst parts of that, because instead it focuses on technical details while flattening out interesting style or the characters behind them.
Well, and this is the thing. So basically, with this scene out of the way, Nick finally agrees, but for a larger cut of the money. As he points, it's like, fine, I'll do it, but I need $6 million, not four. Which leads to, again...
Because he's like, I'm doing it in my backyard, and there's more risk. And I do love Brando's comeback, where he's like, you're telling me this like I never pay you after a job. You know for a fact I pay you. And De Niro, without missing a beat, goes, yeah, and I know what you pay me, too, and I need more.
Exactly. And it's the thing. They basically get it down to the fact that the scepter's probably going to bring in millions of dollars, and yeah, he wants his $6 million cut going forward. And from this point, yeah, the film ends up on rail, and it won on rails in some way, where we do get at least a few interesting sequences. Probably the one where De Niro goes... basically into the tunnels underneath Montreal, or into the sort of sewer system / power grid.
Yeah, because they're trying to lead him using the sewer and like blueprint maps to figure out a route for how he can get in. So you have Bert and Jack driving around in a car, making snide eyes at one another, and talking over the radio to De Niro. Which, again, like, there is that man echo where it's like, all right, this is the operation. We've got this plan down to the last detail. Even when we're casing the joint, here's the relay, here's the map, here's the attention. But there's nothing about this whole sequence that's interesting.
Well, in
like this... the only moment of tension is when Nick is climbing out of the sewer and a policeman almost sees him. But rather, like, his infiltration to case the building, like, there's no threat of capture. It's just watching them do it.
Well, and I would like to note that this police officer in this instance is also the second actor you'll see with a slight French-Canadian accent here, bringing the total up to two in a movie set in Montreal.
Also, the funniest thing, because, I mean, I used to live in Montreal, if that wasn't clear to begin, but I love how you can tell that De Niro is an American actor, because when he says, pick him up, it's the intersection of Ottawa and De La Montagne.
Yeah.
And he says, pick me up at Ottawa and De La Montagne.
See, and this is the thing where I kept watching this movie and I realized after a while, it's like, I don't know if these characters are meant to be Americans or if some of them are meant to be Canadians. Because at
he's not meant to be American, don't cast Robert De Niro.
But that's the thing that throws me, is where it's like, okay, I'm pretty sure that there's no way that they're trying to pass off De Niro as Canadian. I'm not sure about Jack.
Well, his bar is called NYC, so that's his gimmick.
And that's the thing. But Jack, is he supposed to be Canadian, or is he an American? Is Brando supposed to be Canadian? Is he an American? Angela Bassett, again, for all we know, she's an American who's just in Montreal.
Sounds like you're a little worried about birth certificates there, David. Something else you want to tell us?
My point being here is that it's just like, it's just so weird that you make a film in Montreal and then center it on a group of effectively American actors when, for the most part, there's no discernible reason some of them couldn't be from Montreal themselves going through here. It's just, it's such a weird, weird choice to me to do that. But at any rate, the big thing is...
But on the heels of casing, like, we sort of see a couple developments. On the one hand, Jack's quick thinking keeps them from getting their cover blown, and we see there's more of a sense of begrudging respect forming between him and Nick. The other thing is they discover a complications. They've got enhanced security measures, and as they soon discover, even though Nick is an expert safecracker, this is basically a brand new, like, top-line, impossible-to-drill safe.
Now, let me be clear about this, folks, because this customs house is run by the Canadian federal government here. And I'm not saying that they are necessarily dicey with how they spend their money, but the amount of paperwork that would probably have to be pushed through in order to get these advanced security measures put in because of one scepter is very, very unlikely here. So I'm calling BS on that. But
But I mean, it has to happen for the narrative to actually go somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they end up realizing, though, that Because this is where I feel like the metatext of the film becomes the narrative, because Nick suddenly realizes, well, he can't do it entirely on his own either. They need to come up with a new plan, and that involves them getting engineering access codes, basically. So in the full sense of 2001 using the term, effectively, so Norton can hack into the building.
Yes. Now, okay, fine, sure enough.
And this is easily the worst section of the movie.
And this is because, yes, this ends up introducing us to the character of Steven. Basically, a man who is Nick's right-hand computer man, seemingly, for hacking the webs and doing things online. Basically, if you want to assume that he's going up against Alan Cumming's character from GoldenEye, that's about...
What is it he says? He says, yeah, give me an Ampex modem and a live dial tone, I'll get you whatever you need, while he's playing Quake 3 in his bedroom and screaming at his mother.
Yes, because he lives in the basement with his mother, and yeah, that is, it is every...
Well, I mean, who else would have the time to learn computers?
Yeah.
Nero's too cool for that. He appreciates jazz music.
I'm just looking at this to realize that you came out 2 years after The Matrix, dudes. I mean...
Yes.
You had time to make adjustments, all right?
But 6 years after Hackers.
Exactly. But this is where you get to see, it's like, this is definitely old men running the show because they know nothing here. But
I mean, the whole sequence is just... It seems so tonally odd because, I mean, it does give us the tense exchange in the park, because it turns out that Steven is effectively counter-hacked by low-level systems administrator, who then blackmails them for $50,000 for the codes, otherwise he'll turn them over to the police. All that comes of it is... We then end up getting, one of those really formally systematic scenes that I find interesting, where we have the park handoff, where it's Norton talking to the guys, making eyes to signal at De Niro, who's talking into a phone to Steven, who's verifying the codes in real time, while they're being covered and checked on by Bert. And that scene is the film doing it well, right? It's almost like... going back to Coppola again, the conversation, how so much, especially that opening scene, the way that it navigates space through edits and the way that it basically reassembles surveillance aesthetics with film is fascinating. And this almost comes close to that. But it's also tempered by the fact that every time we cut to Steven, we get a sniveling guy in a dark room, codified as a nerd, being like, shut up, mom, I'm hacking.
Yeah.
And it's like, the only reason this scene is that long is because audiences in 2001 didn't have a firm grasp of hacking or how it worked or how long it takes.
Well, exactly.
It's the only sequence of the film that feels like it ever tries to be humorous, because the rest of this film is very straight-laced. So it almost feels like it's cut out of another film.
Well, and this is the thing. The part of the problem is there's not much in the way of legitimate humor, which is odd coming from Frank Oz, a guy who's mostly specialized in making comedies.
But, well, yeah, going back to the top, that's why this film seems such an odd choice for him.
Yeah, and I mean, I will say, I do like the fact that basically what we are dealing with here is a scene where they're getting blackmailed by absolute incompetence. Because our guys show up and they clearly don't know what's going on. And Norton's having to point out, and it's like, no, don't take the money out. You don't count the money in the park there.
It's like, count it in the bag if you have to.
Yeah.
But that... I do like, the scene's a good showcase for just how charming Ed Norton is. Because I feel like a lot of his stalls are ad-libs.
Yeah.
But some of it is just so disarmingly funny. Like when he looks and he's like, so are you guys maternal cousins or...
Yeah, that stuff works well, extremely well. What I'm less sold on is at the end of the scene, when it suddenly Nick is chastising Jack for having brought the gun to the thing. And it's not because this scene only exists to continue to emphasize the fact that Nick is the noble criminal, because he doesn't actually put people at risk. He doesn't actually kill anybody. He is somebody who completely is against firearms, seemingly. Never mind the fact that he seems to be okay with his buddy going over and beating a guy up to get him to get out of town. But it's
all
like,
it is, you got to be a professional. You have to have a code, right?
Well, exactly. But I mean, it's that sort of thing where it's like, again, this is strictly existing so that we can set up that, you know, Jack is the untrustworthy one and the you know, the wild card.
Or at the very least, the hothead, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, again, we didn't need that to emphasize it. We already got the point here. But at any rate,
I mean, you already told us that before we were even introduced to the character on screen, you know? Yeah. It's like, that's the one angle they have, so they have to keep looping back to it. But it's like, come on, Frank, we get it.
Yeah.
I think what bothers me is not so much the predictability of that narrative as a trope, but that there are many, as we said, many, like, sort of meeting of the generations, you know, and not just where they're opposites. I'm thinking, like, Spy Game with Robert Redford and Brad Pitt. De Niro, like, 2 years later, did 15 Minutes with Ed Burns, which I will say is a lot worse than this one. Kelsey Grammer's also in that. Oh, man, I almost forgot. But, like, the problem is, I was actually thinking this afternoon about, in all those narratives, I have seen precisely one where it doesn't work out, that the old guy was right all along, his authority was never threatened, and he comes out on top by sticking to old ways. And the only exception, which is even debatable, is Matchstick Men, where Sam Rockwell outswindles Nicolas Cage and gets off with the money. But it's also a narrative where the way it ends, it's kind of like, yeah, but Nicolas Cage ended up getting something even more important. So, like, I think what bothers me about this film, like, I would like it so much better if Jack's the one who gets away clean, or it shows that, yeah, Nick, that's what happens when you break your code and you take a gamble. Bad things happen to you. Because, as Jack points out, De Niro's breaking his own advice constantly through the film, and literally, the worst thing that happens is Ed Norton pulls a gun on him and he has to wait a minute before he runs away. And then 5 minutes later, we realize, oh no, he foresaw that and switched bags. So he never had the scepter out of his possession.
Well, and this is the thing, like, it's, yeah, it just, it does not work.
It's like, have the old man take the loss just once. It doesn't always have to be like running into Ozymandias's TV room.
Well, and here's the thing, like, there are two sort of key scenes really leading up to this that are worth discussing. Maybe three, okay. We'll see. Like, okay, first of all, we get the complication with the safe, and we get a scene where we see that De Niro has the safe door, basically, in his thing, and he's got his sort of workshop where he's trying to figure out how he can work around this. And he's, and again, in one of the few times, he's pointing out the different elements of the locking mechanism and why their usual approach wouldn't work. And Norton's Jack is basically asking, it's like, well, how are we going to get around that? And you just see De Niro hand him basically a clipboard with his plans there, and you just see Jack flip through it. It's like, is this going to work? Could this actually be pulled off?
How long is this going to take? And like, it basically comes off as it's deployed in the film, like any Bad News Bears type movie, this is that one weird trick play they came up with.
Well, and this is the thing where it's like, I'm thinking back to another Michael Mann film, Thief, where again, you see, you know, James.
So I haven't seen Thief.
Yeah, and Thief is amazing though, because there is the heist sequence in that one and basically how they break into the vault. And it is this exceptionally stylish sequence where basically they have to rig together this high density, basically flamethrower that is able to melt through steel extremely quickly. And it is stylish. It is staged. The minutiae that Mann puts into that to sort of meticulously detail how they're doing this, it's riveting stuff. What this ultimate plan that they come up with is as follows here. Because you're sitting there and thinks, oh, they're baiting the audience. You know, there's going to be this big, you know, real cool thing they're going to pull off at the end here.
Yeah, they do a swerve. It turns out that they actually blow up, the Montreal City Hall, so no one's paying attention to the customs office.
Well, this is the thing where you think it's like, okay, they've got to have some really cool complex plan going on here. Basically, what it boils down to is De Niro's going to drill the top of the safe, fill it with water from an overhead pipe, and then put a stick of dynamite down it. That's it, folks. That's the plan.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it's a depth charge. It's kind of novel, but it's like, but Nick didn't invent drills or water or pressure changes in a liquid system. So, like, again, going back to the idea of story credits on this one, it's like, how much real story is being added at the level of innovation?
Well, and
because, I mean, like, the problem is, it's like, it's one thing to have a genre film that's pretty on rails. Like, L.A. Confidential is a genre film, and it is one of my favorite movies ever made. It is also one of my picks for best American films ever made. But the downside is, if you do it inexpertly, you're left with a bunch of easily understood icons and archetypes without any real investment. And, like, I think when the film works well, you know, it's like the opening, where simply through being able to see De Niro's face, we could already read what his character is thinking and what his motivation is. And there are scenes like this where it's like, well, I see you filling up a safe with water and then blowing it up from the inside, but, like, that's not such an exciting reveal that it necessitates the film treating it like a magic trick.
Well, it's also a scene that when you look at it, you very quickly realize Frank Oz isn't a stylist. And the problem, and it's, again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but the problem is when your sequence is that straightforward, you need to find ways to sort of cinematically make that riveting and click in a way that he just does not have at in his bag of tricks, because we're basically have a wide shot of De Niro standing on a safe drilling into it. It's not dynamic. It's not innovative framing of the scene in terms of how it's shot. And yeah,
and there's no real sense of tension. Like, there are cross cuts to Norton as he's, you know, giving advisement over the radio and stuff. Your standard fare, but it's not like to the level where any conflict or threat is signaled. We also get cuts back to the guards in the security room, and the most they ever seem to do is like, "Did you hear something? Maybe you should check it out." "Oh, it's fine." So you're right, David. Without style and without the threat there, there's really not much of an opportunity for tension to build. And, like, thinking about maybe the first heist film we saw, Machine Gun McCain, yeah, we hated that movie. That is a terrible film. That is an incredibly well-done heist scene.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I won't say that I necessarily hate Machine Gun McCain. It's not a good movie, but at least when it does what it does well, it's doing it well. And here, it's just like, you're doing a lot of things just okay, and
yeah, and it seems disappointing to think of it in those terms, though, because as we said, like, this is a film that's all on rails to the heist, so naturally you would think the heist itself would be the centerpiece and the biggest thing, and it turns out that really the most narratively tense moment is not the heist, but immediately after the heist.
Well, yes, but before we even get to that point, I mean, two scenes we should probably hit on. One, in terms of false drama, we finally have another scene where Nick and Max meet each other, where Max is, yes, hanging out in his basement there, and there's the thought where, because of the additional complications of extra security cameras that have now been installed as well, there's the thought of maybe we have to walk away from this. Max is basically sort of winding up, like, "You gotta do the job, and I'm sitting here in my hot tub for reasons unknown." And, you know,
no, it's not just that, because Bert tells De Niro that people have been talking that someone, Teddy Salinas, knows about the job, and he's been doing business with Max.
But that's the problem.
I mean, normally I was saying that I like when movies sort of have those expansive openings. The problem is the next 5 minutes is them arguing about this Teddy Salinas guy, and we don't know who that is.
Well, that's exactly what the problem here is. Again, they're aiming to do a David Mamet thing here where it's like they are name dropping somebody and that person's going to be significant in some way. Guess what, folks? You will never see this guy in the film at all. He is not a looming threat in any meaningful way to this movie. So it's
like, well, exactly. Like, Godot famously never shows up, but the work itself is structured around that absence. You know, Teddy here is not that silent figure off screen that we know they have to do this job for or he'll kill them or anything like that. He's just a guy that is brought up for literally this scene.
And that's the thing. And this scene is already two-thirds of the way through the movie, so who cares by this point? I mean, unless you're going to suddenly have him show up and, like, you know, basically cut De Niro's arm off or do something horrendous to suddenly and say, this is our threat, we don't care. And,
yeah. And but, I mean, the scene between De Niro and Brando is good only because... How could it not be, like, the two of them playing off each other? Their scenes together, you can clearly see they have an affinity for one another, and they're clearly enjoying it. But, like, yeah, because Max basically explains, he's like, well, yeah, I brought in some people and I'm in over my head, but yes, we can make a lot of money, and what was I supposed to do? How else are we going to get out of this life? And, I mean, like, I think there's more that could be made of that, but... This is really Max's penultimate scene in the film.
Yeah.
Because the last time we see him is him relievedly watching TV.
Well, and that's exactly it. It's just like, this is such a bizarre placement for a scene. And I just, like, I honestly do, it serves no ultimate narrative function other than to give that false moment of, well, maybe Nick's going to walk away from all this. But no, of course he's going to do it because you don't build
a
film.
It makes more sense to put this scene in the first third of the film rather than the last third.
Well, exactly. But this eventually brings us to, after, you know, sort of a moment of bonding between Nick and Jack, where Nick lays out, it's like, you know, you don't take risks, you don't do anything, you don't take long shots, you just do your job, you stick with
what you know. Yeah, because they're talking in the cafe, and I think it's a well-acted scene, even if the script's kind of lacking and De Niro's not fun, because Jack is trying to get him to open up, and he's like, come on, you say that you never take a chance on anything. But you had to have at least once, right? What about when you were young? And that's when Nick lays out his code. But Jack rightly points out, he's like, yeah, you say you never take shots, but here you are talking to me, a guy you don't know, about to do the riskiest job you've ever done. So clearly, you are dreaming of something. Yeah. But like, the problem is the film also never ever takes us away from having sympathy for Nick. Because I feel like it would be more interesting to confront that idea of, like, generational hypocrisy, or at least get Nick to think inward a little bit. Instead, like, that's just the last line in the scene, and he goes to have dinner with Angela Bassett.
Well, and that's exactly it. It's like, again, there's stuff there. There's material that, you know, you could be playing with in terms of subtext and at that moment, or even paratext or metatext. Like, there's a lot of things you could do with it, and the film just takes the safest, most directly quote-unquote dramatic route possible, where it's like, yep, we did one pass at the script, even though I know they did multiple passes at the script, and nope, it's fine. We don't need to do anything extra to add some oomph to this.
Well, I mean, there's something bitterly ironic, though, about this scene, though, because you have two generations of criminal and two generations of Hollywood leading man, and you have the young, ambitious one being told by the older one, stay in your lane, because the moment you try and get cute or the moment you start bending the rules, that's when you go down. And funny enough, Robert De Niro has been staying in his lane and got a plum gig as Robert Mueller on SNL and was even in Joker last year, whereas Ed Norton rightly called out the Academy for frivolity and wasteful spending and basically couldn't get work for 10 years.
With Norton, I mean, I think part of it as well is that he basically chose not to play a lot of Hollywood games after a certain point, and I think... Basically, once it was very... I, and honestly, I know this is, you know, jumping ahead a number of years, but the minute Marvel decided not to bring him back as Bruce Banner, that was the moment, I think, where it was officially... It's like, Ed Norton's never going to be the leading man in a Hollywood film ever again.
Yeah, but he ended up being in Birdman. I think he's absolutely satisfied with how things...
I'm not saying that he's dissatisfied. I think he's very much happy with his career as it's turned out. I haven't seen Motherless Brooklyn, the film he directed last year as of yet.
Oh, yeah, where he plays another addled character.
Yeah, like who's... Yeah, I don't know whether it's going to be any good. I'm keeping my thoughts tempered, or my expectations tempered.
I've heard not great, but I mean, that was also pre-quarantine, so who even knows what that world was. Like, I like Ed Norton, but again, I mean, that's sort of, maybe that's why, sort of the fact that this film ends with Jack effectively being slapped down, why that rubs me so raw, because, like, this is a scene that would not have been bitterly ironic in 2001. This is a scene that's only bitterly ironic because you're watching it in 2020.
Well, exactly.
And so that sort of gets you back to the only interesting things about this film are the meta elements of this film and how they inform the text rather than anything about the text.
Well, exactly. So all of this is basically leads us to the big heist thing. And again, if there's any, as we sort of already note here, this is one of those things where this should be your showpiece of the movie, if nothing else, and it fails on almost every level to deliver as being a really dramatic moment. Because effectively, yes, what ends up happening is Jack goes in to work in his Brian disguise, is hanging out with Danny, Paul Souls, the old man who's taken a shine to him, who I swear, if they could have cast Stan Lee to play this character,
yeah, they would.
Exactly.
He's very doddering.
Exactly.
Like, I don't even think we need to walk much through the heist, because we've kind of hit all the broad notes about it. But, like, it ends in the tunnel with the showdown at gunpoint. And, like, we get Jack, like, very angrily saying, he's like, "What? You thought I didn't realize that you and Max were working together? You think I don't know what that thing is worth? You think I haven't figured out that you're probably getting paid $6 million for this? That's not what I'm getting paid, and this was my job. I put it together. All you guys did was come on board, railroad me. Well, no, that's not how this works." And the problem is, it's like Hugh Laurie's motivation speech in Tomorrowland, where they're the villain, and they are also completely correct.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I mean, this is a case where it's like, yeah, I mean, everything he says makes a logical amount of sense. It's basically a film that's counting on that you're on Team De Niro because he's been around longer at the end of the day. And again, when you get right down to it, the big clever thing that, again, Nick does is he brings along a giant wrench that's generally in the shape of the scepter and put it in a bag while he puts the scepter in a separate thing that he carries on his back. Yeah, that's the big switcheroo here, folks. That's how clever this
And I mean,
is.
Like, it's just, it's frustrating, though, because this is a film about professional men who do things with clockwork precision. And I mean, you know, sort of both of them escape from the scene, and then we get the phone call between them. Jack is basically calling from the Montreal Harbor Front saying he's going to be out of the country in a couple minutes and just wanted to call and rub it into Nick. And I do like the line of dialogue that sets it up, the reveal, because he's like, "You aren't even going to realize where I'm going once I hang up this phone." What is it he goes in with? He's like, "Oh yeah? Yeah? How far do you think you're going to get with what you've got?" And then Edward Norton says, "Ha, you know what I've got." And then he pauses, and I like how he lets the realization come to him.
Yeah, that's a good
moment. Because then he frantically opens the bag and realizes he's been duped. But I refuse to believe for a second that a film all about professionals and their clockwork precision, that between the double cross, booking his ticket out, changing his clothes, waiting until daylight, and traveling across Montreal, that Norton wouldn't look in the bag.
Like, this is a film that wants to seem more sophisticated and clever than it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Cloverfield ending, where you break your own rules for the sake of a shocker ending.
Well, yes. I mean, for me, it's just, that's the thing where I get frustrated with these films, where it's putting on airs of being something classier and more sophisticated and more meaningful than it is.
Yeah. Red 2 has literally the same ending, and it's stupid, but it doesn't try to pretend that it's sophisticated.
Well, that's the thing. The Red movies are basically big, dumb action movies, but they don't pretend to be anything other than big, dumb action movies. This...
Well, yeah. As we talked about on 24 Panels, like, yeah, it's stupid and annoying, but what do you really expect?
Well, yeah, and that's my thing where this film, where it's like, this is a bunch of, again, generally very talented people, but what they've cooked up here is a very generic piece that they've basically puffed up by their presence in order to make it into something it's not. And again, if...
Well, yeah, and I think maybe that's a good way to explain where this film goes wrong, because you have three prestige actors working with a very ordinary tale to tell.
Yeah, like, and that's exactly, if you had, and again, I mean, you know, I was joking about Steven Weber earlier, although, let's be fair, Steven Weber is a very talented actor. the point being here, I mean, if this were a made-for-TV movie shot in Montreal with, you know, a much more affordable cast, and probably casting a bunch of actual local Canadian actors in at least several roles here, you know, this thing would be, you know, I'd probably be much more pleased by it, or at least sit there and say, it's like, it's not great, but you know what? It's serviceable. Matt Frewer was nice in the De Niro role. You know, something to...
Yeah, he could do it. Yeah. Like, honestly, David, the more we've talked about it, it actually has come true. The more I realize this film does kind of miss its mark. Like, watching it, I was pleasantly surprised because only... I remember the last time I saw it being very frustrated by it. And this time, there's probably been about 15 years since I last watched it. As an older viewer, I mean, I can definitely appreciate the import of seeing, you know, generations of actors come together on screen on an affectative level that as a young viewer I simply would not. But I mean, that's not a great reason to spend $50 million and everybody's time, is it?
Well, and this is the thing. Like, let's be clear here. When I say the film is fine, if you have no other options and it's there and you're just looking for a heist film, it'll do the job. If you are somebody who has never seen a heist movie in your life, I don't know how you got here, but I mean, you can watch in the, this is your first time watching, you're probably going to enjoy it a lot more than people who've probably watched about 20, 30, 40, 50 of these types of movies in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And that's...
I guess it's more like there are a lot of films that are far worse aesthetically, narratively, any way you want to look at it. There are many films that are far worse than this one, yeah. But there are also many films that are far better, and they do not have the collective strength of the four main players in this film, or at least they have a better understanding of how to utilize those strengths.
Well, exactly, and I think that's ultimately the thing where you come down to it, where it's just like a bunch of, really, and again, this is a very male film, but it is a bunch of old white guys got together, figured maybe we'll enjoy working together. And in the case of three out of the four of them, that seemed to have been generally the case, you know, and they went ahead, they shot this movie. And again, if they had just, you know, sat there and said, come see the heist movie with De Niro and Norton, and, you know, that was the end of it. Okay. You puff it up and make it, it's like, oh no, it's Norton and De Niro. Oh, man, this is going to be something big going down here. Well, okay, but you've set yourself up.
Something notable must have pulled these people together. Thanos had the Infinity Gauntlet, and Frank Oz had a scepter in a Montreal basement.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing where it's like, I mean, again, this is just a very decent programmer. And again, you know, this is the kind of movie you give to up-and-comers to sit there and say, well, can they lead a movie? Do they have charisma? And again, by this point in everybody's career that's involved in this, we all know that they can carry films. Like, nobody's questioning that. You know, this is the thing you give to somebody else where it's like, are we sure? Are we not sure? Let's test the wheels here.
Oh no, we forgot to get an actual up-and-comer. I'm not gonna lie, David. I'm kind of done talking about this movie because I'm just going to dislike it more and more. And I mean, like, literally, we have come to the end of this film. As this film, it does the reveal, and then we see Max watching TV where they announce that Jack has been named as the suspect. A worldwide manhunt has begun. A second suspect who has been unidentified cannot be located. And then we see Nick greet Angela Bassett as she gets off the airplane, and as they turn and walk away, the credits roll.
Yeah.
So, I think maybe it's about time to roll credits on this one. You're right, you killed my optimism. Turns out that watching movies and studying them does actually make you a dumb jerk. That being said, this is also a film I have no natural segue there. It's time now for Hits and Hits, where we celebrate and condemn the little things. And Dave,
yes.
I would like you to go first for Frank Oz's 2001 heist film, The Score.
I'm straight ahead going to be giving it to Howard Shore, because whatever else I can say about this movie, about the, you know, basically it just sort of coasting on things, I like Howard Shore's work here. I mean, this is not going to be the most memorable score in his body of work, but he does, I mean, you know, they probably sat there and said, it's like, you're going to get to write some sort of jazz compositions. And his view was like, hey, fine, I'm happy with doing that.
It's very Quincy Jones in Oh, what was the one? Mirage.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of hot jazz, a lot of gradually building cymbal beats and that. But like, it works. It gives the scenes a sense of direction and kineticism that I guess the editing patterns don't necessarily create.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, whenever you, I mean, at the very least, if you tune out while watching this movie, you know, the score is going to be at least, it's like, oh yeah, no, it's pleasant listening. And I mean, you know, pleasant listening for a generally pleasant while watching it movie. So, I mean, for that reason alone, I am going to give, you know, Howard Shore credit for that. But yeah, this isn't going to replace his work in Cronenberg's films or Silence of the Lambs or anything like that, folks. So
yeah.
What about you, Andrew? What's your first hit for this one, if I haven't completely ruined everything for you?
I know you're not a big fan of the visual style of this movie, but I would actually give it to cinematographer Rob Hahn. And last week, looking at In and Out, we talked about how Rob Hahn was a very unremarkable cinematographer, and that In and Out is a very unremarkably styled movie. Part of it is probably owing to the natural architecture of Montreal, but I mean, Montreal has a very distinctive character as a city that is unlike many other places in North America. Seeing it on screen does feel different, but like, I feel like this is a film that shot well. Like, there's at least more of a sense of lighting and blocking in scenes. That opening, the use of shadows, and the brief flickers of light as De Niro is almost caught, I think that's really well done. Even like the tunnel scene, like, it's, again, it's not going for broke. It's not Greg Toland here, but it is. It certainly looks a lot more polished and flashy than literally any other Rob Hahn film I've seen. So on the basis that I didn't think a film looking this good could have come from the guy whose last film I saw, I'm going to give it to Rob Hahn, maybe just being nice as like a most improved player sort of thing. Dave, do you have a second hit for this film?
To sort of build off of it, it's like, well, I'm probably not going to credit Rob Hahn. I am going to credit production designer Jackson DeGoiva and Audie Bronson Howard for their production design and costume design, respectively. I mean, again, it's not breaking the mold in any way, but they...
I like Brando's outfits.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, there are some nice touches here. And again, everything looks good and of a piece. And again, I think, you know, the sort of the way in which, you know, browns as a color sort of hues throughout this film. It's like, when you take a look at De Niro's apartment in this movie, like, I really like that sort of lived-in woodsy texture that everything has there. And that's the thing. I think if Hahn does come off well, it's because, again, the sets here and the costumes here are far more interesting visually to start with, before you even begin lighting the scenes. And I think his lighting is, it's solid. I mean, it's very workmanlike and it does the job it's asked of it there. And I will agree.
Yeah, it's not Roger Deakins in Skyfall level here, but I mean, you know, it's certainly more noteworthy than any other, than most other Frank Oz films I've seen that don't have plants that eat people.
Well, and that's exactly it. So, I mean, on that level, it's like, again, I give full credit for my second hit to, again, the behind-the-scenes talent really working on this one. What about for you, Andrew, any other hits for this one?
I mean, it's hard because it feels like everything's tarnished, but I'm probably going to give it to Edward Norton, only because this is a film that's very much sold on the performances of characters. Obviously, Jack, there's the metatext where his character has the most to prove as the up-and-comer, and in a certain sense, I can see Norton having that same sense where it's like, I'm the least established brand here, so I need to bring my A-game to justify being with these guys. I think out of the whole, Jack is the most dynamic performance, the most interesting one, and the one that feels least like whole cloth archetype. You know, granted, we have talked about that so much of his ability to work people involves disguising himself as a stereotypically mentally challenged individual, but I mean, I'm not going to talk about how Norton plays that. I'm going to say that this is a film where I was rooting for Norton, and I do every single time, and that's probably because of something he's bringing to the film.
Yeah.
And now probably for the more exciting part, where we talk about the downside, the things we hate. So Dave, other than what we've talked about in the conversation proper, what is your first pick for the score.
I'm really going to double down on this one. The way in which Gary Farmer and Angela Bassett are wasted in this movie. Because, look, let's be clear here. Those are both remarkable performers. In the case of Gary Farmer, he's probably much less famous than Bassett is. But if you've seen his work in Blood Quantum from just last year, he is phenomenal and on fire in that movie. We saw him in Dead Man, where he is phenomenal and on fire in that movie.
I'll admit that I only know him for the films he's done with Jim Jarmusch, so I can't make any claims to his abilities overall as an actor, but I do know that Dead Man, he probably is the most noteworthy performance, and that's a film that involves Johnny Depp, Gabriel Byrne, Lance Henriksen, yep. Need I go on?
Well, and that's exactly it. Like, he is a standout performer, and he basically gets wasted as De Niro's right-hand heavy in this movie. Like, he has...
Like, he has an amazing sense of screen presence, and it's like... Frank Oz heard that and said, okay, let's just make him be a presence on the screen.
Well, and that's the thing what blows my mind. He's like, especially given the fact that it is Frank Oz, because Gary Farmer has amazing comedic timing as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and he is completely given an unfunny role in this movie. Like, that is such a waste when it's like you have somebody who you could give some fun dialogue to, who could make it sing, and you do nothing. Likewise, Bassett is way overqualified to be in this movie. Like, this is embarrassingly a bad waste of her. And I think very much shows that when it comes to what the focus of this movie was, Frank Oz was caring about his male leading figures and gave two hoots about everything else.
Well, I mean, Bassett, like, to her credit, she distills more life and humanity into a paper-thin character than I think the film really deserves. Like, it's not like she's phoning it in here. She makes the character feel real and inhabited. There's just not nearly enough of it. But I think you're right, Dave, that there is something kind of distasteful when the only two people of color in the film are literally reduced, like, not even metaphorically, they are carrying the luggage of the other characters around.
Well, and that's exactly it. That is just, like, it feels wrong in this movie. And...
Well, and that's sort of the danger of doing, like, a film like The Expendables or like, you know, The Mechanic, or where the general ethos is old guys still got it, you know. Red, you have Carl Urban be relegated to the sidelines because it's shut up, new generation. Old white guys still know what they're doing. You haven't heard The Last of Us yet. And it's like, well, can't we, though? Yeah. You know, imagine the film where it turns out that Bert was actually the one who double-crosses everybody, and it turns out him and Bassett drive off with the money. That would have been not enough to make this a progressive text, but a much more satisfying ending.
Yeah.
I probably would be complaining less.
Well, at the very least, it's like, well, I admit, I did not see that coming. And at least it would have gotten Angela Bassett something to actually do on screen with her time. But it's a shame. What about you, Andrew? What would be your first pit for this one?
I mean, honestly, I think my big pit coming out of this conversation and having thought of it, like, there is a lot of productive potential, and, I mean, there's more potentials that are signaled by the fact that you have capable actors working with weak material. I'm like, yeah, I mean, this was going to be one where I'm like, I think Lem Dobbs has a pretty sharp script, and the more we talk about it, the more I'm like, no, he really didn't this time. And then I think about it, and I'm like, and he really doesn't. Other times, maybe the Limey was kind of the odd one out.
Well, this is the thing, and I'm not sure how much to put on Dobbs necessarily, because this is something where we had, you know, at least two other writers involved with. I would suspect that he was probably brought on to do a lot of cleanup after the fact, or dialogue polishes. But either way,
I mean, based off the Dobbs films I have seen, this does feel like sort of tonally of a piece. So it feels. Like, to me, as a viewer, I just naturally associate that with the Lem Dobbs style, rather than basing that off any knowledge of who did what.
Well, given that the guy who wrote the story basically was writing things for Tim Conway, I can safely assume it was probably not his voice that was the dominant one here.
Well, at least this film would have had a couple yucks then. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess if I have to give the blanket pit, it's just... failure of imagination, you know, Because, I mean, I went into this thinking, like, no, I think this is a film that's firmly within a genre, but I mean, it ticks the boxes. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, and going back to that original question we asked one another, I'm no longer sure that's enough.
Well, exactly, and that's the thing. It's like, again, and I do feel bad that I ruin in some ways ruin this for you, but
Oh, that's okay. I've got many other movies I can watch.
but that's the thing. I mean, it really is. There's a reason I don't think people remember the score, and it honestly comes down to was it's fine. It came out, it did its thing, and it probably is best left in the memory bin where it should be for now.
I mean, it's notable because, again, it's Brando's last film, and it's Brando, De Niro, and Norton sharing the screen together. But you really have to ask yourself, like, those are the reasons why this film came into being. Other than that, though, those are the only reasons why this film is remembered at all, right? For being historical trivia. And I mean, like, in a way, it's fitting, though, when the only reason you're doing this film is to get the three people together, that's the only thing anybody is ever going to remember of it. So start as you mean to go on, Frank Oz.
Yeah, fair enough. So I guess the
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if there's much more to do with this one. So I have a feeling the next movie we're looking at is not going to be in Montreal. So, Dave, as our wheelman, why don't you tell us where we are going to be heading next episode?
So, Lem Dobbs. You might have noticed that we came down a little hard on him there. We are gluttons for punishment on the show, and sometimes we make choices that are dubious because they will lead us to mu seemingly much more interesting paths down the road.
As well, David, I mean, there are a number of films, even in pandemic times, that come out in limited release and have that reputation of it is so bad that you actually need to see it in order to understand how wrong it goes. And ordinarily, I'm the type of person that says, but I'm not going to seek out a bad movie to watch it. Why would I spend my time on that?
The problem is we have a podcast, and
I finally have that reason to watch it, at least.
Exactly. So
What are we going to be looking at,
we are
Dave?
going to be following Lem Dobbs to the John Travolta Vanity Project, starring him and his late w wife there.
Kelly Preston.
Yes, and that is 2018's Gotti. Yes, starring, yes, John Travolta, as the client that Bruce Cutler also helped at one point.
Yeah, I know that I know the film largely through blogger and entertainment opiner Nathan Rabin's treatment of the film. I would encourage people to read it because even without having seen the film, his review, it's like the Guy Fieri Times Square restaurant where it's just like, as a piece of criticism, I feel like this is kind of in a league unto itself. I have not seen it yet. I'm very excited to, though, because I know at least I'll get to talk about it with you.
Yeah, I've not seen it yet myself. Funny enough, I was in a Giant Tiger today and I saw a Blu-ray copy there, and it's like, ooh, well, it's cheap, but you know what? It's on Netflix, and I feel better not paying any more than I have to for this. So,
Exactly. Your shelves are load-bearing enough, and man, oh man, we'll be carrying quite a burden next time. So, in the meantime, Dave, though, if people want to tell us that we don't respect old white people enough, where can people get in touch with you?
Frank Oz can yell at me at 24 panels online. I promise not to insult you using the characters you played on the Muppets. However, I am going to take you to task for that Stepford Wives remake. What about you, Andrew? Where can the people contact you?
I'll probably be nice to Frank Oz because it's cool to meet famous people, but then I'll probably needle him a bit being like, so, what was it like being an accessory to John Landis in two films? You
Jesus.
can find me at Film Stripper, or you can email our show directly if you got more than 280 characters to say, and you can reach us directly at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, you can rate and review us in iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. Across the board, 5-star reviews certainly help move us up the featured chart and get new listeners to our show. And above all, it's an easy way to signpost how we doing these days. I know after 2.5 years, We've been remarkably consistent in some ways, and we've changed it up here and there. Let us know. I mean, the only goal with this show is to keep bringing you a show you want to listen to. So, you know, whatever way is easiest for you, get in touch and let us know.
Yeah. So with that, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Freaking monotony's coming after me and still...
Oh, my God. I was just going to say, we didn't do nearly enough Brando voices. We'll be right back.